but he frightened her all the same. "I won't let them take us," she vowed silently, reaching back over her shoulder to touch the hilt of the sword that Gentry had stolen for her. "I won't." Late that afternoon, they emerged from beneath the trees and found themselves on the banks of a river. Hot Pie gave a whoop of delight. "The trident! Now all we have to do is go upstream like you said. We're almost there." Arya chewed her lip. "I don't think this is the trident." The river was swollen by the rain, but even so, it couldn't be much more than 30 feet across. She remembered the trident as being much wider. "It's too little to be the trident," she told them, "and we didn't come far enough." "Yes, we did," Hot Pie insisted. "We rode all day and hardly stopped at all. We must have come a long way." "Let's have a look at that map again," said Gendry. Arya dismounted, took out the map, unrolled it. The rain pattered against the sheepskin and ran off in rivulets. "We're someplace here, I think," she said, pointing, as the boys peered over her shoulders. "But," said Hot Pie, "that's hardly any ways at all. See, Harrenhal's there by your finger. You're almost touching it. And we rode all day." "There's miles and miles before we reach the Trident," she said. "We won't be there for days. This must be some different river. One of these, see?" She showed them some of the thinner blue lines the mapmaker had painted in, each with a name painted in fine script beneath it. "The Derry, the Green Apple, the Maiden, here, this one, the Little Willow, it might be that." Hot Pie looked from the line to the river. "It doesn't look so little to me." Gendry was frowning as well. "The one you're pointing at runs into that other one, see?" "The Big Willow," she read. "The Big Willow, then, see? And the Big Willow runs into the Trident, so we could follow the one to the other. But we need to go downstream, not up. Only if this river isn't the Little Willow, if it's this other one here..." "Ripple down rill," Arya read. "See, it loops around and flows down toward the lake, back to Harrenhal." He traced the line with a finger. Hot Pie's eyes grew wide. "No! They'll kill us for sure." "We have to know which river this is," declared Gendry, in his stubbornest voice. "We have to know." "Well, we don't." The map might have names written beside the blue lines, but no one had written a name on the river bank. "We won't go up or downstream," she decided, rolling up the map. "We'll cross and keep going north, like we were." "Can horses swim?" asked Hot Pie. "It looks deep, Harry. What if there are snakes?" "Are you sure we're going north?" asked Gendry. "All these hills, if we got turned around, the moss on the trees." He pointed to a nearby tree. "That tree's got moss on three sides, and the next one has no moss at all. We could be lost just riding around in a circle." "We could be," said Arya. "But I'm going to cross the river anyway. Now you can come, or you can stay here." She climbed back into the saddle, ignoring the both of them. If they didn't want to follow, they could find river on their own, though more likely the mamas would just find them. She had to ride a good half mile along the bank before she finally found a place where it looked as though it might be safe to cross, and even then her mare was reluctant to enter the water. The river, whatever its name, was running brown and fast, and the deep part in the middle came up past the horse's belly. Water filled her boots, but she pressed her heels in all the same and climbed out on the far bank. From behind she heard splashing and a mare's nervous whinny. They followed then. Good. She turned to watch as the boy struggled across and emerged dripping beside her. "It wasn't a trident," she told them. "It wasn't." The next river was shallower and easier to ford. That one wasn't the trident either, and no one argued with her when she told them they would cross it. Dusk was settling as they stopped to rest the horses once more and share another meal of bread and cheese. "I'm cold and wet," Hot Pie complained. "We're a long way from Harrenhal now, for sure. We could have us a fire."
"No,"
Arya and Gendry both said at the exact same instant. Hot Pie quailed a little. Arya gave Gendry a sideways look. "He said it with me, like John used to do, back in Winterfell." She missed Jon Snow the most of all her brothers.
"Could we sleep, at least?" Hot Pie asked. "I'm so tired, Arya, and my arse is sore. I think I've got blisters."
"You'll have more than that if you're caught," she said. "We've got to keep going, we've got to.
But it's almost dark, and you can't even see the moon. Get back on your horse."
Plodding along at a slow walking pace as the light faded around them, Arya found her own exhaustion weighing heavy on her. She needed sleep as much as Hot Pie, but they dare not. If they slept, they might open their eyes to find Vargo Hoat standing over them, with Shagwell the Fool, and faithful Urswick, and Rorg, and Biter, and Septon Utt, and all his other monsters. Yet after a while the motion of her horse became as soothing as the rocking of a cradle, and Arya found her eyes growing heavy. She let them close just for an instant, then snapped them wide again. "I can't go to sleep," she screamed at herself silently. "I can't, I can't." She knuckled at her eye and rubbed it hard to keep it open, clutching the reins tightly and kicking her mount to a canter. But neither she nor the horse could sustain the pace, and it was only a few moments before they fell back to a walk again, and a few more until her eyes closed a second time. This time they did not open quite so quickly. When they did, she found that her horse had come to a stop and was nibbling at a tuft of grass, while Gentry was shaking her arm.
"You fell asleep," he told her.
"I was just resting my eyes."
"You were resting them a long while, then. Your horse was wandering in a circle, and it wasn't till he stopped that I realized you were sleeping. Up Pie's just as bad. He rode into a tree limb and got knocked off. You should have heard him yell. Even that didn't wake you up. You need to stop and sleep."
"I can keep going as long as you can," she yawned.
"Liar," he said. "You keep going if you want to be stupid, but I'm stopping. I'll take the first watch. You sleep."
"What about Hot Pie?" Gendry pointed. Hot Pie was already on the ground, curled up beneath his cloak, on a bed of damp leaves and snoring softly. He had a big wedge of cheese in one fist, but it looked as though he had fallen asleep between bites. It was no good arguing, Arya realized. Gendry had the right of it. "The mummers will need to sleep too," she told herself, hoping it was true. She was so weary it was a struggle even to get down from the saddle, but she remembered to hobble a horse before finding a place beneath a beech tree. The ground was hard and damp. She wondered how long it would be before she slept in a bed again with hot food and a fire to warm her. The last thing she did before closing her eyes was unsheathe her sword and lay it down beside her. "Sir Gregor," she whispered, yawning, "Dunson, Pollover, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler, the Tickler, the Hound." Her dreams were red and savage. The mummers were in them, four at least, a pale Lyseni and a dark, brutal axeman from Ib, the scarred Dothraki horse lord called Iggo, and a Dornishman whose name she never knew. On and on they came, riding through the rain, in rusting mail and wet leather, swords and axe clanking against their saddles. They thought they were hunting her, she knew with all the strange, sharp certainty of dreams, but they were wrong. She was hunting them. She was no little girl in her dream. She was a wolf, huge and powerful, and when she emerged from beneath the trees in front of them and bared her teeth in a low, rumbling growl, she could smell the rank stench of fear from horse and man alike. The Lyseni's mount reared and screamed in terror, and the other shouted at one another in man-talk, but before they could act, the other wolves came hurtling from the darkness and the rain, a great pack of them, gaunt and wet and silent. The fight was short, but bloody. The hairy man went down as he unslung his axe. The dark one died, stringing an arrow, and the pale man from Lice tried to bolt. Her brothers and sisters ran him down, turning him again and again, coming at him from all sides, snapping at the legs of his horse, and tearing the throat from the rider when he came crashing to the earth. Only the Beld man stood his ground. His horse kicked in the head of one of her sisters, and he cut another almost in half with his curved, silvery claw, as his hair tinkled softly. Filled with rage, she leapt onto his back, knocking him head first from his saddle. Her jaws locked on his arm as they fell, her teeth sinking through the leather and wool and soft flesh. When they landed, she gave a savage jerk with her head and ripped the limb loose from his shoulder. Exulting, she shook it back and forth in her mouth, scattering the warm red droplets amidst the cold black rain. Tyrion. He woke to the creak of old iron hinges. "Oh!" he croaked. At least he had his voice back, raw and hoarse though it was. The fever was still on him, and Tyrion had no notion of the hour. How long had he slept this time? He was so weak, so damnably weak. "Oh!" he called again, more loudly. Torchlight spilled through the open door, but within the chamber the only light came from the stub of a candle beside his bed. When he saw a shape moving toward him, Tyrion shivered. Here in Maegor's Holdfast, every servant was in the Queen's pay, so any visitor might be another of Cersei's cat's paws, sent to finish the work Sir Mandon had begun. Then the man stepped into the candlelight, got a good look at the dwarf's pale face, and chortled. "Cut yourself shaving, did you?" Tyrion's fingers went to the great gash that ran from above one eye down to his jaw, across what remained of his nose. The proud flesh was still raw and warm to the touch. "With a fearful big razor, yes." Bronze coal-black hair was freshly washed and brushed straight back from the hard lines of his face. He was dressed in high boots of soft tulle leather, a wide belt studded with nuggets of silver, and a cloak of pale green silk. Across the dark grey wool of his doublet, a burning chain was embroidered diagonally in bright green thread. "Where have you been?" Tyrion demanded of him. "I sent for you. It must have been a fortnight ago."
4 days ago, more like," the sellsword said, "and I've been here twice and found you dead to the world."
"Not dead, though my sweet sister did try."
Perhaps he should not have said that aloud, but Tyrion was past caring. Cersei was behind Sir Mandon's attempt to kill him. He knew that in his gut.
"What's that ugly thing on your chest?"
Bronn grinned.
"My knightly sigil. A flaming chain, green, on a smoke-grey field. By your lord father's command, I'm Sir Bronn of the Blackwater now. Imp. See you don't forget it."
Tyrion put his hands on the feather bed and squirmed back a few inches against the pillows.
"I was the one who promised you knighthood, remember?"
He'd like that, by your lord father's command, not at all. Lord Tywin had wasted little time. Moving his son from the Tower of the Hand to claim it for himself was a message anyone could read, and this was another.
"I lose half my nose, and you gain a knighthood. The guards have a deal to answer for."
His voice was sour.
"Did my father dub you himself?"
"No. Them of us as survived the fight at the Winch Towers got ourselves dabbed by the High Septon and dubbed by the King's Guard. Took half the bloody day, with only 3 of the White Swords left to do the honours."
"I knew Sir Mandon died in the battle."
"Shoved into the river by Pud. Half a heartbeat before the treacherous bastard could drive his sword through my heart.
Who else was lost?"
"The Hound," said Bronn. "Not dead, only gone. The gold cloaks say he turned craven, and you led a sortie in his place.
Not one of my better notions. Tyrion could feel the scar tissue pull tight when he frowned. He waved Bronn toward a chair.
My sister's mistaken me for a mushroom. She keeps me in the dark and feeds me shit. Pud's a good lad, but the knot in his tongue is the size of Casterly Rock, and I don't trust half of what he tells me. I sent him to bring Sir Jocelyn, and he came back and told me he's dead.
Him and thousands more, Bronn said.
How?
Tyrion demanded, feeling that much sicker.
During the battle. Your sister sent the Kettle Blacks to fetch the king back to the Red Keep, the way I hear it. When the Gold Cloaks saw him leaving, half of them decided they'd leave with him. Iron Hand put himself in their path and tried to order them back to the walls. They say Bywater was blistering them good, and almost had him ready to turn when someone put an arrow through his neck. He didn't seem so fearsome then, so they dragged him off his horse and killed him.
Another debt to lay at Cersei's door.
My nephew, he said, Joffrey, was he in any danger?
No more than some, and less than most.
Had he suffered any harm, taken a wound, mussed his hair, stubbed his toe, cracked a nail?
Not as I heard.
I warned Cersei what would happen. Who commands the gold cloaks now?
Your lord father's given them to one of his westermen, some knight named Adam Marbrand.
In most cases, the gold cloaks would have resented having an outsider placed over them. But Sir Adam Marbrand was a shrewd choice. Like Jaime, he was the sort of man other men liked to follow.
I have lost the city watch. I sent Pod looking for Shagar, but he's had no luck. The stone crows are still in the king's wood. Shagar seems to have taken a fancy to the place. Timmet led the burn men home with all the plunder they took from Stannis's camp after the fighting. Chella turned up with a dozen black ears at the river gate one morning, but your father's red cloaks chased them off, while the Kingslanders threw dung and cheered.
Ingrates, the black ears died for them.
Whilst Tyrion lay drugged and dreaming, his own blood had pulled his claws out one by one.
I want you to go to my sister. Her precious son made it through the battle unscathed, so Cersei has no more need of a hostage. She swore to free Arya once.
She did. 8-9 days ago, after the whipping.
Tyrion shoved himself up higher, ignoring the sudden stab of pain through his shoulder.
Whipping? They tied her to a post in the yard and scourged her, then shoved her out of the gate, naked and bloody.
She was learning to read, Tyrion thought absurdly. Across his face, the scar stretched tight, and for a moment it felt as though his head would burst with rage. Alayaya was a whore, true enough, but a sweeter, braver, more innocent girl he had seldom met. Tyrion had never touched her. She had been no more than a veil to hide Shae. In his carelessness, he had never thought what that role might cost her.
I promised my sister I would treat Tommen as she treated Alayaya, he remembered aloud.
He felt as though he might retch.
How can I scourge an 8-year-old boy?
But if I don't,
Cersei wins.
You don't have Tommen, Bronn said bluntly. Once she learned the Iron Hand was dead, the queen sent the Kettle Blacks after him, and no one at Rosby had the balls to say them nay.
Another blow. Yet a relief as well, he must admit it. He was fond of Tommen.
The Kettle Blacks were supposed to be ours, he reminded Bronn, with more than a touch of irritation.
They were, so long as I could give them 2 of your pennies for every one they had from the queen. But now she's raised the stakes. Osney and Offrey were made knights after the battle, same as me. Gods know what for. No one saw them do any fighting.
My hirelings betray me. My friends are scourged and shamed, and I lie here, rotting,
Tyrion thought.
I thought I won the bloody battle. Is this what triumph tastes like? Is it true that Stannis was put to rout by Renly's ghost?
Bronn smiled thinly. From the winch towers, all we saw was banners in the mud and men throwing down their spears to run. But there's hundreds in the pot shops and brothels who'll tell you as how they saw Lord Renly kill this one or that one. Most of Stannis's host had been Renly's to start, and they went right back over at the sight of him in that shiny green armour. After all his planning, after the sortie and the bridge of ships, after getting his face slashed in two, Tyrion had been eclipsed by a dead man. If indeed Renly is dead, something else he would need to look into. How did Stannis escape? His Lysenes kept their galleys out in the bay beyond your chain. When the battle turned bad, they put in along the bay shore and took off as many as they could. Men were killing each other to get aboard, toward the end. What of Robb Stark? What has he been doing? There's some of his wolves burning their way down toward Duskendale. Your father's sending this Lord Tarly to sort them out. I'd half a mind to join him. It said he's a good soldier and open-handed with the plunder. The thought of losing Bronn was the final straw. Know your place is here. You're the captain of the Hand's Guard. You're not the Hand, Bronn reminded him sharply. Your father is, and he's got his own bloody guard. What happened to all the men you hired for me? Some died at the Winch Towers. That uncle of yours, Sir Kevin, he paid the rest of us and tossed us out. How good of him, Tyrion said acidly. Does that mean you've lost your taste for gold? Not bloody likely. Good, said Tyrion, because as it happens, I still have need of you. What do you know of Sir Mandon Moore? Bronn laughed. I know he's bloody well drowned. I owe him a great debt, but how to pay it? He touched his face, feeling the scar. I know precious little of the man, if truth be told. He had eyes like a fish, and he wore a white cloak. What else do you need to know? Everything, said Tyrion, for a start. What he wanted was proof that Sir Mandon had been Cersei's, but he dare not say so aloud. In the Red Keep, a man did best to hold his tongue. There were rats in the walls and little birds who talked too much, and spiders. Help me up, he said, struggling with the bedclothes. It's time I paid a call on my father, and past time I let myself be seen again. Such a pretty sight, mocked Bronn. What's half a nose on a face like mine? But speaking of pretty, is Margaery Tyrell in King's Landing yet? No, she's coming, though, and the city's mad with love for her. The Tyrells have been carting food up from Highgarden and giving it away in her name. Hundreds of wains every day. There's thousands of Tyrell men swaggering about with little golden roses sewn on their doublets, and not a one is buying his own wine. Wife, widow, or whore, the women are all giving up their virtue to every peach-fuzz boy with a gold rose in his tit. They spit on me and buy drinks for the Tyrells. Tyrion slid from the bed to the floor. His legs turned wobbly beneath him. The room spun, and he had to grasp Bronn's arm to keep from pitching headlong into the rushes. Pod! He shouted. Podrick Payne! Where in seven hells are you? Payne gnawed at him like a toothless dog. Tyrion hated weakness, especially his own. It shamed him, and shame made him angry. Pod, get in here! The boy came running. When he saw Tyrion standing and clutching Bronn's arm, he gaped at them. My lord, you stood. Is that... Do you need wine? Dream wine? Shall I get the maester? He said you must stay abed, I mean. I have stayed abed too long. Bring me some clean garb. Garb? How the boy could be so clear-headed and resourceful in battle, and so confused at all other times, Tyrion could never comprehend. Clothing, he repeated, tunic, doublet, breeches, hose, for me to dress in, so I can leave this bloody cell. It took all three of them to clothe him. Hideous though his face might be, the worst of his wounds was the one at the juncture of shoulder and arm, where his own mail had been driven back into his armpit by an arrow. Pus and blood still seeped from the discolored flesh whenever Maester Franken changed his dressing, and any movement sent a stab of agony through him. In the end, Tyrion settled for a pair of breeches and an oversized bedrobe that hung loosely about his shoulders. Bronn yanked his boots onto his feet, while Pod went in search of a stick for him to lean on. He drank a cup of dream wine to fortify himself. The wine was sweetened with honey, with just enough of the puppy to make his wounds bearable for a time. Even so, he was dizzy by the time he turned the latch, and the descent down the twisting stone steps made his legs tremble. He walked with a stick in one hand and the other on Pod's shoulder. A serving girl was coming up as they were going down. She stared at them with wide white eyes, as though she were looking at a ghost. "The dwarf has risen from the dead," Tyrion thought. "And look, he's uglier than ever. Run, tell your friends." Maegar's Holdfast was the strongest place in the Red Keep, a castle within the castle, surrounded by a deep dry moat lined with spikes. The drawbridge was up for the night when they reached the door. Sir Meron Trant stood before it in his pale armour and white cloak. "Lower the bridge," Tyrion commanded him. "The Queen's orders are to raise the bridge at night." Sir Meron had always been Cersei's creature. "The Queen's asleep, and I have business with my father." There was magic in the name of Lord Tywin Lannister. Grumlin, Sir Meron Trant, gave the command, and the drawbridge was lowered. A second Kingsguard knight stood sentry across the moat. Sir Osmond Kettleblack managed to smile when he saw Tyrion waddling towards him. "Feeling stronger, my lord?" "Much. When's the next battle? I can scarcely wait." When Pod and he reached the Serpentine Steps, however, Tyrion could only gape at them in dismay. "I will never climb those by myself," he confessed to himself. Swallowing his dignity, he asked Bronn to carry him, hoping against hope that at this hour there would be no one to see and smile, no one to tell the tale of the dwarf being carried up the steps like a babe in arms. The outer ward was crowded with tents and pavilions, dozens of them. "Tyrell men," Podrick Payne explained as they threaded their way through a maze of silk and canvas. "Lord Rowan's, too, and Lord Redwine's. There wasn't room enough for all. In the castle, I mean. Some took rooms in the city, in inns and all. They're here for the wedding, the king's wedding, King Joffrey's. Will you be strong enough to attend, my lord?" "Ravening weasels could not keep me away." There was this to be said for weddings over battles, at least. It was less likely that someone would cut off your nose. Lights still burned dimly behind shuttered windows in the Tower of the Hand. The men on the door wore the crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms of his father's household guard. Tyrion knew them both, and they admitted him on sight, though neither could bear to look long at his face, he noted. Within they came upon Sir Adam Marbrand, descending the turnpike stair in the ornate black breastplate and cloth of gold cloak of an officer in the city watch.
"Oh, my lord," he said, "ha! How good to see you on your feet. I'd heard
rumours of a small grave being dug. Me too. Under the circumstances, it seemed best to get up. I hear you're commander of the city watch. Shall I offer congratulations or condolences?"
"Both, I fear," Sir Adam smiled. "Death and desertion have left me with some 4,400. Only the guards and Littlefinger know how we're going to go on paying wages for so many. But your sister forbids me to dismiss any."
"Still anxious, Cersei. The battle's done. The gold cloaks won't help you now." "Do you come from my father?" he asked.
I fear I did not leave him in the best of moods. Lord Tywin feels 4,400 guardsmen more than sufficient to find one lost squire. But your cousin Tyrek remains missing."
Tyrek was the son of his late uncle Tyget, a boy of 13. He had vanished in the riot. Not long after wedding, the Lady Ermisande, a suckling babe who happened to be the last surviving heir of House Hayford, and likely the first bride in the history of the Seven Kingdoms to be widowed before she was weaned. "I couldn't find him either," confessed Tyrion. "He's feeding worms," said Bronn, with his usual tact. Ironhand looked for him, and the eunuch rattled a nice fat purse. They had no more luck than we did. "Give it up, sir." Sir Adam gazed at the sellsword with distaste.
"Lord Tywin is stubborn where his blood is concerned. He will have the lad alive or dead, and I mean to oblige him."
He looked back to Tyrion.
"You will find your father in his solar."
"My solar?" thought Tyrion.
"I believe I know the way."
The way was up more steps, but this time he climbed under his own power, with one hand on Pud's shoulder. Bronn opened the door for him. Lord Tywin Lannister was seated beneath the window, writing by the glow of an oil lamp. He raised his eyes at the sound of the latch.
"Tyrion."
Calmly, he laid his quill aside.
"I'm pleased you remember me, my lord."
Tyrion released his grip on Pod, leaned his weight on the stick, and waddled closer.
"Something is wrong," he knew at once.
"Sir Bronn," Lord Tywin said, "Podrick, perhaps you'd better wait without until we are done."
The look Bronn gave the hand was little less than insolent. Nonetheless, he bowed and withdrew, with Pod on his heels. The heavy door swung shut behind them, and Tyrion Lannister was alone with his father. Even with the windows of the solar shuttered against the night, the chill in the room was palpable.
What sort of lies has Cersei been telling him?
The Lord of Castle Rock was as lean as a man 20 years younger, even handsome in his austere way. Stiff blond whiskers covered his cheeks, framing a stern face, a bald head, a hard mouth. About his throat he wore a chain of golden hands, the fingers of each clasping the wrist of the next.
"That's handsome chain," Tyrion said, "though it looked better on me."
Lord Tywin ignored the sally.
"You had best be seated. Is it wise for you to be out of your sick bed?"
"I am sick of my sick bed."
Tyrion knew how much his father despised weakness. He claimed the nearest chair.
"Such pleasant chambers you have. Would you believe it, while I was dying, someone moved me to a dark little cell in Magor's."
"The Red Keep is overcrowded with wedding guests. Once they depart, we will find you more suitable accommodations."
"I rather like these accommodations. Have you set a date for this great wedding?"
"Joffrey and Margaery shall marry on the first day of the new year, which, as it happens, is also the first day of the new century. The ceremony will herald the dawn of a new era."
"A new Lannister era," thought Tyrion.
"Oh, bother, I fear I made other plans for that day."
"Did you come here just to complain of your bedchamber and make your lame japes? I have important letters to finish."
"Important letters, to be sure.
Some battles are won with swords and spears, others with quills and ravens. Spare me these coy reproaches, Tyrion. I visited your sick bed as often as Maester Balabar would allow it, when you seem like to die."
He steepled his fingers under his chin.
"Why did you dismiss Balabar?"
Tyrion shrugged.
"Maester Franken is not so determined to keep me insensate."
"Balabar came to the city in Lord Redwine's retinue. A gifted healer, it said. It was kind of Cersei to ask him to look after you. She feared for your life."
"Feared that I might keep it, you mean?" "Doubtless that's why she's never once left my bedside."
"Don't be impertinent. Cersei has a royal wedding to plan. I'm waging a war, and you have been out of danger for at least a fortnight."
Lord Tywin studied his son's disfigured face, his pale green eyes unflinching.
"Though the wound is ghastly enough, I'll grant you. What madness possessed you?"
"The foe was at the gates with a battering ram. If Jaime had led the sortie, you'd call it valour."
"Jaime would never be so foolish as to remove his helm in battle. I trust you killed the man who caught you?"
"Oh, the wretch is dead enough." Though it had been Podrick Payne who killed Sir Mandon, shoving him into the river to drown beneath the weight of his armour. "A dead enemy is a joy forever," Tyrion said blithely, though Sir Mandon was not his true enemy. The man had no reason to want him dead.
"He was only a cat's paw, and I believe I know the cat. She told him to make certain I did not survive the battle."
But without proof, Lord Tywin would never listen to such a charge.
"Why are you here in the city, father?" he asked. "Shouldn't you be off fighting Lord Stannis or Robb Stark or someone?"
"And the sooner the better."
"Until Lord Redwine brings his fleet up, we lack the ships to assail Dragonstone." "It makes no matter. Stannis Baratheon's son set on the Blackwater. As for Stark, the boy is still in the west, but a large force of Northmen under Helmund Tallheart and Robert Glover are descending towards Duskendale. I sent Lord Tarly to meet them, while Sir Gregor drives up the King's Road to cut off their retreat. Tallheart and Glover will be caught between them with a third of Stark's strength."
"Duskendale?"
There was nothing at Duskendale worth such a risk. Had the young wolf finally blundered?
"It's nothing you need trouble yourself with. Your face is pale as death, and there's blood seeping through your dressings. Say what you want, and take yourself back to bed."
"What I want?"
His throat felt raw and tight. What did he want?
"More than you can ever give me, father. Pod tells me that Littlefinger's been made Lord of Harrenhal."
"An empty title, so long as Roose Bolton holds the castle for Robb Stark. Yet Lord Baelish was desirous of the honour. He did us good service in the matter of the Tyrell marriage. A Lannister pays his debts."
The Tyrell marriage had been Tyrion's notion, in point of fact, but it would seem churlish to try to claim that now.
"That title may not be as empty as you think," he warned. "Littlefinger does nothing without good reason. But be that as it may, you said something about paying debts, I believe."
"And you want your own reward, is that it? Very well. What is it you would have of me? Lands? Castle? Some office?"
"A little bloody gratitude would make a nice start."
Lord Tywin stared at him, unblinking.
"Mummers and monkeys require applause. So did Ares, for that matter. You did as you were commanded, and I'm sure it was to the best of your ability. No one denies the part you played."
"The part I played?"
What nostrils Tyrion had left must surely have flared.
"I saved your bloody city, it seems to me."
"Most people seem to feel that it was my attack on Lord Stannis's flank that turned the tide of battle. Lords Tyrell, Rowan, Redwine, and Tarly fought nobly as well, and I'm told it was your sister Cersei who set the pyromancers to making the wildfire that destroyed the Baratheon fleet."
"While all I did was to get my nose hairs trimmed, is that it?"
Tyrion could not keep the bitterness out of his voice.
"Your chain was a clever stroke and crucial to our victory. Is that what you wanted to hear? I'm told we have you to thank for our Dornish alliance as well. You may be pleased to learn that Myrcella has arrived safely at Sonspear. Sir Aerys Urquhart writes that she has taken a great liking to Princess Arianne, and that Prince Tristane is enchanted with her. I must like giving House Martell a hostage, but I suppose that could not be helped."
"'We'll have our own hostage,' Tyrion said. "'A council seat was also part of the bargain. "'Unless Prince Doran brings an army when he comes to claim it, "'he'll be putting himself in our power.'
"'Would that a council seat were all Martell came to claim?' "'Lord Tywin said. "'You promised him vengeance as well.'
"'I promised him justice.'
"'Call it what you will, it still comes down to blood.'
"'Not an item in short supply, surely. "'I splashed through lakes of it during the battle.'
"'Tyrion saw no reason not to cut to the heart of the matter.
"'Or have you grown so fond of Sir Gregor Clegane "'that you cannot bear to part with him?'
"'Sir Gregor has his uses, as did his brother. "'Every lord has need of a beast from time to time.' A lesson you seem to have learned, judging from Sir Bronn and those clansmen of yours.
Tyrion thought of Timmet's burned eye, Shagger with his axe, Cello with a necklace of dried ears, and Bronn. Bronn most of all.
The woods are full of beasts, he reminded his father. The alleyways as well.
True. Perhaps other dogs would hunt as well. I shall think on it. If there's nothing else,
you have important letters, yes.
Tyrion rose on unsteady legs, closed his eyes for an instant as a wave of dizziness washed over him, and took a shaky step toward the door. Later he would reflect that he should have taken a second, and then a third. Instead, he turned.
"'What do I want?' you ask. "'I'll tell you what I want.' I want what is mine by rights. I want Casterly Rock.
His father's mouth grew hard.
Your brother's birthright.
The knights of the King's Guard are forbidden to marry, to father children, and to hold land. You know that as well as I. The day Jaime put on that white cloak, he gave up his claim to Casterly Rock, but never once have you acknowledged it. It's past time. I want you to stand up before the realm and proclaim that I am your son and your lawful heir.
Lord Tywin's eyes were a pale green flecked with gold, as luminous as they were merciless.
Casterly Rock,
he declared in a flat, cold, dead tone, and then,
never.
The word hung between them, huge, sharp, poisoned.
I knew the answer before I asked, Tyrion thought. 18 years since Jaime joined the King's Guard, and I never once raised the issue. I must have known. I must always have known.
Why?
He made himself ask, though he knew he would rue the question.
You ask that? You who killed your mother to come into the world? You are an ill-made, devious, disobedient, spiteful little creature full of envy, lust, and low cunning. Men's laws give you the right to bear my name and display my colours, since I cannot prove that you are not mine. To teach me humility, the gods have condemned me to watch you waddle about wearing that proud lion that was my father's sigil and his father's before him. But neither gods nor men shall ever compel me to let you turn Casterly Rock into your whorehouse.
My whorehouse?
The dawn broke. Tyrion understood all at once where this bile had come from. He ground his teeth together and said,
Cersei told you about Alaeya.
Is that her name? I confess I cannot remember the names of all your whores. Who was the one you married as a boy?
Taisha,
he spat out the answer defiant.
And that camp follower on the Green Fork.
Why do you care?
He asked, unwilling even to speak Shay's name in his presence.
I don't, no more than I care if they live or die.
It was you who had Yaya whipped.
It was not a question.
Your sister told me of your threats against my grandsons.
Lord Tywin's voice was colder than ice.
Did she lie?
Tyrion would not deny it.
I made threats, yes, to keep Alayaya safe, so the Kettle Blacks would not misuse her.
To save a whore's virtue, you threatened your own house, your own kin. Is that the way of it?
You were the one who taught me that a good threat is often more telling than a blow. Not that Joffrey hasn't tempted me sore a few hundred times. If you're so anxious to whip people, start with him. But Tommen? Why would I arm Tommen? He's a good lad, and my own blood.
As was your mother.
Lord Tywin rose abruptly to tower over his dwarf son.
Go back to your bed, Tyrion, and speak to me no more of your rights to Casterly Rock. You shall have your reward, but it shall be one I deem appropriate to your service and station, and make no mistake. This was the last time I will suffer you to bring shame unto House Lannister. You are done with whores. The next one I find in your bed, I'll hang.
Davos. He watched the sail grow for a long time, trying to decide whether he would sooner live or die. Dying would be easier, he knew. All he had to do was crawl inside his cave and let the ship pass by, and death would find him. For days now the fever had been burning through him, turning his bowels to brown water and making him shiver in his restless sleep. Each morning found him weaker.
It will not be much longer, he had taken to telling himself.
If the fever did not kill him, thirst surely would. He had no fresh water here, but for the occasional rainfall that pooled in hollows on the rock. Only 3 days passed, or had it been four? On his rock it was hard to tell the days apart. His pools had been dry as old bone, and the sight of the bay, rippling green and grey all around him, had been almost more than he could bear. Once he began to drink seawater, the end would come swiftly, he knew. But all the same, he had almost taken that first swallow, so parched was his throat. A sudden squall had saved him. He had grown so feeble by then that it was all he could do to lie in the rain with his eyes closed and his mouth open, and let the water splash down on his cracked lips and swollen tongue. But afterward, he felt a little stronger, and the island's pools and cracks and crevices once more had brimmed with life. But that had been 3 days ago, or maybe four, and most of the water was gone now. Some had evaporated, and he had sucked up the rest. By the morrow he would be tasting the mud again, and licking the damp cold stones at the bottom of the depressions. And if not thirst or fever, starvation would kill him. His island was no more than a barren spire, jutting up out of the immensity of Blackwater Bay. When the tide was low, he could sometimes find tiny crabs along the stony strand, where he had washed ashore after the battle. They nipped his fingers painfully before he smashed them apart on the rocks to suck the meat from their claws and the guts from their shells. But the strand vanished whenever the tide came rushing in, and Davos had to scramble up the rock to keep from being swept out into the bay once more. The point of the spire was 15 feet above the water at high tide, but when the bay grew rough, the spray went even higher, so there was no way to keep dry, even in his cave, which was really no more than a hollow in the rock beneath an overhang. Nothing grew on the rock but lichen, and even the seabirds shunned the place. Now and again some gulls would land atop the spire, and Davos would try to catch one, but they were too quick for him to get close. He took to flinging stones at them, but he was too weak to throw with much force. So even when his stones hit, the gulls would only scream at him in annoyance and then take to the air. There were other rocks visible from his refuge, distant stony spires taller than his own. The nearest stood a good 40 feet above the water, he guessed, though it was hard to be sure at this distance. A cloud of gulls swirled about it constantly, and often Davos thought of crossing over to raid their nests. But the water was cold here, the current strong and treacherous, and he knew he did not have the strength for such a swim. That would kill him as sure as drinking sea water. Autumn in the narrow sea could often be wet and rainy, he remembered from years past. The days were not bad, so long as the sun was shining, but the nights were growing colder, and sometimes the wind would come gusting across the bay, driving a line of white caps before it, and before long Davos would be soaked and shivering. Fever and chills assaulted him in turn, and of late he had developed a persistent racking cough. His cave was all the shelter he had, and that was little enough. Driftwood and bits of charred debris would wash up on the strand during low tide, but he had no way to strike a spark or start a fire. Once in desperation, he had tried rubbing two pieces of driftwood against each other, but the wood was rotted, and his efforts earned him only blisters. His clothes were sodden as well, and he had lost one of his boots somewhere in the bay before he washed up here. Thirst, hunger, exposure. They were his companions, with him every hour of every day, and in time he had come to think of them as his friends. Soon enough one or other of his friends would take pity on him and free him from this endless misery. Or perhaps he would simply walk into the water one day and strike out for the shore that he knew lay somewhere to the north, beyond his sight. It was too far to swim, as weak as he was, but that did not matter. Davos had always been a sailor. He was meant to die at sea.
"The gods beneath the waters have been waiting for me," he told himself. "It's past time I went to them."
But now there was a sail. Only a speck on the horizon, but growing larger.
A ship where no ship should be.
He knew where his rock lay, more or less. It was one of a series of sea months that rose from the floor of Blackwater Bay. The tallest of them jutted 100 feet above the tide, and a dozen lesser months stood 30 to 60 feet high. Sailors called them Spears of the Merlin King, and he knew that for every one that broke the surface, a dozen lurked treacherously just below it. Any captain with any sense kept his course well away from them. Davos watched the sail swell through pale, red-rimmed eyes, and tried to hear the sound of the wind caught in the canvas.
"She's coming this way."
Unless she changed course soon, she would pass within hailing distance of his meager refuge. It might mean life. If he wanted it. He was not sure he did.
"Why should I live?"
he thought as tears blurred his vision.
"Gods be good, why? My sons are dead. Dale and Elhart and Merrick and Mathis, perhaps Devon as well. How can a father outlive so many strong young sons? How would I go on? I'm hollow shell. The crab's dead. There's nothing left inside. Don't they know that?"
They had sailed up the Blackwater Rush, flying the fiery heart of the Lord of Light. Davos and Black Betha had been in the second line of battle, between Dale's Wraith and Allard and Lady Maria. Merrick, his third-born, was Oarmaster on Fury, at the center of the first line, while Mathis served as his father's second. Beneath the walls of the Red Keep, Stannis Baratheon's galleys had joined in battle with the boy king Joffrey's smaller fleet, and for a few moments the river had rung to the thrum of bowstrings and the crash of iron rams shattering oars and hulls alike. And then some vast beast had let out a roar, and green flames were all around them. Wildfire, Pyromancer's piss, the Jade Demon. Mathis had been standing at his elbow on the deck of Black Betha when the ship seemed to lift from the water. Davos found himself in the river, flailing as the current took him and spun him around and around. Upstream, the flames had ripped at the sky 50 feet high. He had seen Black Betha afire and Fury and a dozen other ships, had seen burning men leaping into the water to drown. Wraith and Lady Maria were gone, sunk or shattered, or vanished behind a veil of wildfire, and there was no time to look for them, because the mouth of the river was almost upon him, and across the mouth of the river the Lannisters had raised a great iron chain. From bank to bank there was nothing but burning ships and wildfire. The sight of it seemed to stop his heart for a moment, and he could still remember the sound of it, the crackle of flames, the hiss of steam, the shrieks of dying men, and the beat of that terrible heat against his face as the current swept him down toward hell. All he needed to do was nothing. A few moments more, and he would be with his sons now, resting in the cool green mud on the bottom of the bay, with fish nibbling at his face. Instead, he sucked in a great gulp of air and dove, kicking for the bottom of the river. His only hope was to pass under the chain and the burning ships and the wildfire that floated on the surface of the water to swim hard for the safety of the bay beyond. Davis had always been a strong swimmer, and he'd worn no steel that day, but for the helm he'd lost when he lost Black Betha. As he knifed through the green murk, he saw other men struggling beneath the water, pulled down to drown beneath the weight of plate and mail. Davis swam past them, kicking with all the strength left in his legs, giving himself up to the current, the water filling his eyes. Deeper he went, and deeper still. With every stroke it grew harder to hold his breath. He remembered seeing the bottom soft and dim, as a stream of bubbles burst from his lips. Something touched his leg. A snag, or a fish, or a drowning man. He could not tell. He needed air by then, but he was afraid. Was he past the chain yet? Was he out in the bay? If he came up under a ship, he would drown, and if he surfaced amidst the floating patches of wild fire, his first breath would sear his lungs to ash. He twisted in the water to look up, but there was nothing to see but green darkness, and then he spun too far, and suddenly he could no longer tell up from down. Panic took hold of him. His hands flailed against the bottom of the river and sent up a cloud of mud that blinded him. His chest was growing tighter by the instant. He clawed at the water, kicking, pushing himself, turning, his lungs screaming for air, kicking, kicking, lost now in the river murk, kicking, 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 until he could kick no longer. When he opened his mouth to scream, the water came rushing in, tasting of salt, and Davis Seaworth knew that he was drowning. The next he knew, the sun was up, and he lay on a stony strand beneath a spire of naked stone, with the empty bay all around him, and a broken mast, a burned sail, and a swollen corpse beside him. The mast, the sail, and the dead man vanished with the next high tide, leaving Davis alone on his rock amidst the spears of the Merlin King. His long years as a smuggler had made the waters around King's Landing more familiar to him than any home he'd ever had, and he knew his refuge was no more than a speck on the charts, in a place that honest sailors steered away from, not toward. Though Davis himself had come by it once or twice in his smuggling days, the better to stay unseen.
"When they find me dead here, if ever they do, perhaps they will name the rock for me," he thought. "Onion Rock, they'll call it. It will be my tombstone and my legacy."
He deserved no more.
"The father protects his children," the septons taught.
But Davis had led his boys into the fire. Dale would never give his wife the child they had prayed for, and Allard, with his girl in Old Town, and his girl in King's Landing, and his girl in Bravos, they would all be weeping soon. Mathis would never captain his own ship as he dreamed. Marek would never have his knighthood.
"How can I live when they are dead? So many brave knights and mighty lords have died, better men than me, and I born. Crawl inside your cave, Davis. Crawl inside, and shrink up small, and the ship will go away, and no one will trouble you ever again. Sleep on your stone pillow, and let the gulls peck out your eyes while the crabs feast on your flesh. You feasted on enough of them. You owe them. Hide, smuggler, hide, and be quiet and die.